Yes, we are back at Film Fight Club for a summer special, doing it our way.
Yes, this is Virat Nehru.
And this is Chris Evans. Our regular host, Glenn Falkenstein, is away, and so the mice will play.
Yes, that's really good, actually, yeah. Congratulations, Chris. I'm very impressed by your rhyming skills.
Thank you. It's Mutual Appreciation Society, formerly known as Film Fight Club.
Yes, the Lynch and Malick fans have reunited.
Yes, that's
in
right.
In this very special episode without Glenn, because we're doing it our way.
I'll try to work in some Lynch and Malick references. I almost forgot. Thank you for the pre-reminder.
I mean, will it be a Film Fight Club episode without Lynch and Malick?
Yep.
Our patron god, the cinephiles.
That's right. We're doing a summer special episode where we'll talk about some of the significant films that have been released over the summer, but not all of them, because Film Fight Club has never been completionist and isn't going to start now.
Okay, we'll be talking about Glass, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Aquaman, Vice, and The Favourite.
How's your summer been going?
Yeah, it's pretty hot out here, to be honest. I don't know which part of the world you guys are, but if you're in Australia or Sydney or one of those places,
Heatwave.
Yeah, pretty hot, but not in a good way.
Victoria is pretty hot at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, I'm going to the Aussie Open for tennis. So I'm going to see my one true love, Roger Federer.
Funny you say that. I'm going to my one true love, Rainbow Serpent, in Victoria. So we'll have to meet next week, and maybe some of our ramblings will make it into a future episode.
Yeah, well, you know, in the good times, I think both of our one true loves could coexist.
That's true.
I would love to see Roger Federer at Rainbow Serpent one year.
That could be
one of the cool dads.
Yeah.
You know, like 20 years from now or something. You could be one of those things like, man, fame doesn't matter.
Right,
you know,
right.
What is even being famous?
You know,
I did everything.
All that really matters
everything.
Is this moment, right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, right now.
Yeah.
Who am I? Am I even Roger Federer? Am I just some dude talking to some other dude about some things?
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of dudes talking to dudes about things, we saw the big new release of the week, Glass. It's full of dudes talking to dudes. If we're using dudes in the gender neutral sense, because often it's a woman doing the talking.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Anyway, dudes talk to dudes about stuff in the new film from M. Night Shyamalan.
Bruce Willis is dead. Bruce Willis is dead. Bruce Willis is dead.
So, once again, reuniting with Bruce Willis of The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable fame. He doesn't play a ghost in this one. Oh, we broke another Film Fight Club rule for no spoilers. Sorry, dude. Sorry, Glenn.
But yeah, honestly, The Sixth Sense, that was the least impressive part about that movie. Yeah, Bruce Willis is dead. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, M. Night Shyamalan is prone to...
But it's not that great a twist, is it? Like, you know, he's just been dead. You just see ghosts. You know, just get on with it.
Yeah, the M. Night Shyamalan, all the hype around him is about his twists, but often they...
They're pretty lame.
Usually they're even pretty lame.
Also, like, actually, there's so much more interesting stuff going around his actual filmmaking rather than the twist.
Yeah.
I don't even watch his movies for the plot. The plots are the least interesting thing about his style of filmmaking. That goes for the same with Glass, which also has a pretty lame twist.
Yeah. So for those playing at home, Glass is the sequel to Unbreakable and also to the stealth continuation of the Unbreakable universe, Split. Once more, M. Night Shyamalan is back with a very abstract, unusual... I don't know if abstract is the right way to put it, actually, because it explains things a lot.
It does. I mean, there's a lot of exposition about exposition. And this is sort of deep monologues about what it means to be a superhero, what it means to be a hero, are comic book people real?
That's
you
right.
Know? But it's also incredibly self-serious, but also goofy.
Yeah, goofy is the word. It's a very strange mix. Basically, this film catches up with the reluctant superhero and unbreakable David Dunn, who is now...
Dun-dun-dun.
Indeed. I like how he was given a nice comic booky name. You know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
the two of the same, you know, first name, last name. Peter Parker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's the,
Clark Kent.
It didn't even
same
hit
sound.
Me until you just pointed out. Easter eggs.
Right. He is now stalking around Philadelphia neighborhoods, fighting crime, and he's on the case of the Horde, the split personality killer played by James McAvoy.
He's so good. I mean,
he's amazing in this
almost,
movie.
I sometimes feel James McAvoy doesn't deserve to be in this universe because he's
he elevates the film, but I think Shyamalan meets him because the filmmaking around his character is actually M. Night Shyamalan at his best. So I wonder if this is just a magic collaboration.
It is, because actually the physicality of James McAvoy's sort of presence and what he can do and bring to these characters actually comes about because of how Shyamalan is doing his camera positioning. And, you know, there are some very interesting jump scares that happen because of how Shyamalan has positioned the camera.
Well, there's a really interesting way that Shyamalan frames the Horde, James McAvoy, switching between his personalities in one shot with a camera moving over between somebody lecturing him. And then each time the camera pans back, it's a different personality that we're seeing from James McAvoy.
It's very neat filmmaking. And also, like, something you're probably taught in film school, but you kind of forget the bigger you become. Because sometimes the basic things kind of actually work better.
Shyamalan is getting a lot of hate for this film. I feel like we're going to be some of the few to give this a positive review.
Let's go through the plot first, because before we come to the sort of exposition part, we actually like this movie, and I know we're going to have to justify it quite a bit why we liked it.
Film Fight Club is back with the hottest
contrarian,
takes.
Very contrarian.
Very contrarian episode coming up.
I was surprised because I went in to hate this movie, and
I was ready to hate this. Yeah.
But also,
there's so much negativity about this film right now on the internet and the critical discourse.
Like, take away Split and people who were reintroduced to this universe through Split and not through, you know, Unbreakable, this is closer in tone to Unbreakable in a very grounded sensibility than Split.
I think
Split is this kind of outlier which raised people's expectations about the superhero genre. But this movie is a sibling to Unbreakable in how the tone is set.
That's right, because I think people were expecting a big superhero throwdown, because that's what the ending of Split seems to suggest. We've built up this big villain and, oh my God, the grand hero, what's he been like in the last 20 years?
And Shyamalan is clever enough to take the mickey out of that, because he keeps referring to the showdown this entire movie, which is pretty funny.
That's right. I think a big focus of this film is about swerving from expectations. Everything is smaller scale than you might imagine, and whenever something large scale is built up, it doesn't happen. Meanwhile, we have Samuel L. Jackson reprising his role from Unbreakable, Mr. Glass.
Very breakable, very fragile.
Very, very fragile. The title character of this film, the comic book super nerd, giving commentary explaining how the smaller scale skirmishes we're witnessing are actually, this is the final showdown, this is the big climax. And a lot of people are saying this is showing Shyamalan's two up his own ass and it's all self-serious. I actually think this movie's very self-aware. And scenes like that show it. Like, the, you know, grand music playing while people have a fight in a parking lot.
Yeah. And, oh, God. These sort of...
It's also goofy as hell. And
dramatic
Sam Jackson
confrontation scenes are shot in a way that make them more grand than they actually are. Look about it, these are two very old dudes trying very hard to be
something.
There's a lot of physical comedy going on, but not actual grandiose histrionics.
I feel like Shyamalan actually does know what he's doing with the contrast between the small scale and the grand scale of, you know, the music and the framing. That there's a level of self-awareness of the absurdity and the goofiness of comic book movies. I think a lot of people are missing this because it doesn't come with the kind of ironic winking, which movies, for example, always, if ever they try to show their self-awareness, it's in the way of, you know, deprecating themselves and flattering the audience.
Yeah.
Whereas this film, I think, is actually, though it's aware of how ridiculous it is, very, very sincere.
It's very sincere, but also it's making fun of both. It's making fun of its own genre, its own sort of roots, and also the audience for its expectations.
Yeah.
So in a way, Shyamalan is giving the bird to his own film, and also the audience were expecting a certain kind of film from him.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is, I think...
It's a total swerve.
Because some people usually think that Shyamalan is too smart for his own good. Like, you know, that's not a trait in filmmakers that you should admire.
Right.
I'm not sure where I sit on that, but I can see if people would argue from that perspective that he's being deliberately kind of an a-hole,
right.
Then yeah, sure.
When you were bringing up before the fight scenes, I've seen people complaining, I shouldn't be spending so much time reviewing the other reviewers on this movie, but here I go. I've seen people complaining about the fight scene, saying they're awkward and strange, but to me, that was what made them great. As you mentioned before, Virat, that we're just watching a bunch of like middle-aged men grunting at each other.
But hilarious.
That's what they are. But that's
very
what,
laugh-out-loud moments, and I was laughing quite loudly.
Me too. But at the same time, I was getting G'd up. You know, I was getting into it.
Yeah.
The action scenes are, you know, men running at each other, sort of wrestling and gripping each other and banging into things, which is what a real life fight between two burly titans would be like.
Exactly. But also, like, if you think about it, if you think about the scope and the location of this movie and how it doesn't change with the minority of it, these are just two people confined in a space, and then all they do is get out to a park or a garden.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really go anywhere.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's like,
but it's epic.
But it's
but
epic because
you
made it out to the garden. You know? It's like, okay, I just took a walk. Yeah,
I made
cool.
it to the garden. Yeah. Most of the movie is confined to one location, and most of the film is conversations. The plot is really, it seems like it's going to go into some sort of Shyamalan mega twist territory where is this a psychological thriller where we start to question whether anything in the previous films was real or whether it all just existed in the characters' minds. And I actually found some of this stuff really interesting, or at least the feeling that the rug might be pulled from under me at any moment.
But also, that would be a very interesting film about mental health, actually.
The film could have been more interesting than it was.
You know, if we were to embrace the mental health aspect and see where that would have taken
I actually wish the film had gone further in that direction, because I think there are ways that it could have been true to its themes, the same themes that come out in the actual trajectory of the film, without pulling us in. I think, look, the ending is one of the weak points. It's too sudden. There's a massive late-stage Shyamalan twist, which isn't explored enough. It
true.
Comes too late in the film to really resonate. And I think,
But also, I don't think this film needed a twist, to be honest.
No, I don't think
I mean, the actual backbone of this movie is about what it's trying to communicate
That's
through
right.
its themes.
I wish it had just stuck to the direction it was going and brought those themes
because
to the
final,
natural conclusion.
The final scene was actually poignant for me. And, you know, when that happened and how it's filmed. So without the twist, I actually would have bought the sincerity of it.
Yeah.
And the twist is actually the unnecessary.
Right. The weak point of M. Night Shyamalan, I think, has always been his writing, and more specifically his dialogue, which is terrible. And this is a film full of speechifying. I think it's only the goofiness of it that stops me from hating.
Oh, totally. I mean, the dialogue
all the
is terrible.
Dialogue, yeah.
Especially, you know, the Sarah Paulson's character, which is playing a psychiatrist. This is some of the worst psychiatrist dialogue
and
writing I've seen.
Her acting is really too much. The character is too much of like a type as opposed to a person.
I would have loved somebody like Jodie Foster playing it or something.
That would have been great.
I was just thinking, you know, very Silence of the Lambs, very sort of poker-faced would have been much more interesting. I think she kind of made it too obvious.
Yeah. I think if we had seen the film that other critics seem to have seen, then the psychologist character would have just like absolutely killed the film.
Sure.
But I think that there's the realization of this is so ridiculous. Well, you're having arguments about comic book minutiae. You know,
yeah, exactly. But also
details
the fact
and
that
plot arcs between a psychologist and superheroes. And I'm thinking, okay, this is absurd.
And just the fact that it's talking about something called the superhero delusion from comic books. It signposts its ridiculousness quite in the beginning.
Yeah, I think so,
too. If you're not buying into that universe, then this movie is not for you.
Yeah.
Like, you're not looking for some kind of diagnostic manual for level arguments about which kind of mental disorder we're talking about. Nah, it's pretty basic. It's pretty...
It's not that deep.
Yeah.
It's not deep at all.
But part of the fun, like you mentioned, Shyamalan does incredibly well is that the speechifying works to set up these sort of visual cues that work really well for the film.
Yeah, that's right.
For example, the music cues that build up for, you know, this show about very sincere moments about payoffs or about being superheroes. And
I just want to give praise to Shyamalan's visual sense, which I think has developed a long way from his earlier films. I think it's really strong right now. This is really playfully shot. Going back to the fight scenes we're talking about earlier, it's like POV, you know, Snorricam, as Darren Aronofsky, I think, called it, where there's a camera right in the person's face as they're being gripped from behind and twirled around.
But even Glass's first reveal is a POV shot.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Is also
really
very interesting
off-center camera moves. The aforementioned scene where the camera's panning between the Hoard and Sarah Paulson's psychologist.
But also how each character is looked at.
Yeah,
For example, the point of view shot where Sarah Paulson's character is tilting her head to look at glass, and that was a very interesting off-camera
shot. That's
right,
and there's an amazing Hitchcockian zoom in this stare-down moment between Bruce Willis, which is hilarious. I think that the playfulness comes through and was making me laugh.
Which also kind of makes me sad, because what are we expecting from superhero movies now? You know, are we expecting the big spectacle, or are we expecting interesting filmmaking?
Yeah,
which
is an interesting dynamic. This is interesting filmmaking. Yeah. And it's especially interesting because we live in a superhero movie saturated time. People have said, what's the point of this down-to-earth superhero movie in a time when superheroes are a dime a dozen and we are always seeing different versions of it? But I think now is the perfect time for a movie like Unbreakable to come back, because it just sticks a pin into the enormous balloon of superhero world building.
DC has been trying to do this, right, for eternity.
But this is much more successful than the Justice League.
Not in that sense.
Superman.
Yeah, yeah, but DC in that sense about trying to make movies about what it means to be a superhero.
It's gritty.
You know, this kind of philosophical diatribes. But this movie, in its speechifying or whatever, we call them flaws, but they actually contribute to very much sincerity of it, which that lacks.
The speechifying about what it means to be a superhero midway through the movie was actually starting to get to me, and I was finding it quite poignant. It was getting at like what is inspiring about superhero archetypes and the essence of what makes them great, and the idea of believing in something, which is the appeal of comic books.
And also, I
loved that.
Throwaway scenes about this neon with, you know,
in
the bookstore.
Villains.
Hero and villains. A character goes in the bookstore looking for comic books, and he's looking in the heroes aisle, and you have a heroes neon sign.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, I haven't found the right character. And pop, right behind him, it's a villains aisle. Yeah. And that's when he has a brainwave. Maybe I've been looking in the wrong aisle all along. I should be looking in the villains aisle.
There's a hilarious scene of looking through the comic books to find out that
there's a parallel to
a man-beast character exists, and it's accompanied by huge music on the soundtrack. And
but
it's
also like incredible,
that
sort of like,
I don't know.
The
movie is like making the mundane into the epic, but simultaneously being aware that it's pretty mundane.
Shot, because you know it was a back and forth, and each time you're zooming into the comic book panel even more and more and more and more. So it just felt like, you know, that kind of the meme shot where you just keep zooming in.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. And you're like, oh my God, a big reveal. But it's not really.
It's not that big of a reveal.
It's not really. All right. But that's the fun part of it.
All right. So it's no big deal.
Bruce Willis is dead.
That's just Shyamalan's style. He sometimes blows things up when it's like, all right.
But that's the thing. I'm really happy that he's aware of that. He's aware. He
seems to be becoming more self-aware.
And this Blumhouse and Shyamalan kind of co-production
I think it's a good collaboration. They've worked together on his last three films, which have, in my opinion, have really brought him back. Yeah. I think Shyamalan had become a laughingstock, and I think I don't care what other people think about Glass. I think he's back. He's back to making interesting, fascinatingly weird, clumsy.
Because even when he
films
was like
what anyone else is doing, genuinely original.
Even when he was making bad movies, he was still making them bad for spectacularly original reasons.
That's right.
Like, you know,
I think we need M. Night Shyamalan more than ever in the current Hollywood
point to
big
like,
budget
you know,
blockbuster landscape.
A correlative Lady in the Water. Companion piece that I can say. Yeah, I know, but it's such an originally bad film.
It is. Yeah.
I cannot point out same mistakes.
Only a really talented person could make a film.
Such a bad
that.
Film.
Yeah, that's right.
Which has like such trademark Shyamalan badness.
Yes.
Which is just like, you know, only you can think of
that. Be bad in this way.
Exactly. But it's also, did it my way. Yeah. Literally, you know, he makes bad films his own way.
He does, yeah.
I do agree with that. And that's something really endearing about that. Yeah, I think we're losing that in this kind of whatever, this hyper fast
paced
universe.
This is a film that was made with zero input of the studios almost. Shyamalan put in a lot of his own money to guarantee creative control, and God bless him, because no one else is making this kind of weirdness.
It requires patience to
watch it. That's true.
And that's something very interesting, because
it's all about the build-up.
It's all about the build-up.
Yes, and he's always been that way. And I am really thankful that he's sticking with that in a time when we're moving more and more into instant gratification.
And I think what I've heard or what I've read is that most people are disappointed that it doesn't even have a payoff.
Yeah.
It's interesting how the film is about something else entirely. And
It's about something you find along the way. Yeah, but I can see people feeling cheated if they think it's going to be about
Maybe that's more
really
common about our expectations from superhero movies.
That's true, yeah.
Like we're generically fed.
It's all about trying to present something different using superheroes, something completely different to what else is out there. And people are going to go in expecting what the convention dictates, and, you know, this isn't that. That's Glass. We hope you like it, and, you know, it needs more fans.
Just go in with lesser
Go in ready for anything. Notions,
yeah.
I think, yeah. Go in ready for some strange
time.
Directions. So, on the subject of the superhero glut, I didn't see it, but what did you think of Aquaman?
Okay, Aquaman. Oh, wow. This is an interesting segue from like Glass, which is very grounded, to Aquaman, which is completely over the top. It's made a lot of money. Gosh.
It did make a lot of
but
money.
But that hasn't stopped us from completely pooing over some films.
Yep.
So we're going to do it again. Mm. Here we are. Okay, Aquaman is a fun DC movie.
Yep.
That's all. I mean, that's all it's had going for it.
All right, so that was Aquaman.
The thing is, and I'm saying that as a disclaimer because
DC's not usually fun.
I think they're just so self-serious.
Yeah.
Aquaman is the first time where they really thought, what would it be like if our characters could actually have fun? Jason Momoa's character and his actual personality off-screen does a lot to feed into that. I think because he's someone who just oozes a lot of charisma.
Hmm.
And this kind of very playful larrikin, he's basically a Thor replacement.
Seems
it's
to
Marvel's
me to be
Thor.
Going for that like quippy,
yeah.
You know, bro, do, whoa.
But also, I think with Momoa,
comedy.
What the interesting thing is, his dialogue delivery is barely understandable. So you're not actually, yeah. The good thing about that is he gets to do a lot more physical comedy. Chris Hemsworth, I feel, has become a revelation in the comedic space. More than the action space. So I think he should be more explored as a comedic actor. Jason Momoa.
Okay.
I think these kind of very physically bulky dudes are actually so self-aware of their physical sort of, you know, imperviousness and how they physically intimidate people that they can use that to advantage on screen.
Right.
And actually, you know, do some interesting physical comedy. That's probably the most interesting thing about Aquaman, where they're using a very physically intimidating character to basically make fun of that,
right.
Is sort of physical intimidation and how basically how much of a, you know, tank top dude he looks like.
Dude bro.
Yeah. So in that sense, about masculinity and what it takes to be, you know, a self-aware man in the 21st century and have the mantle of a superhero, I think it's got a very interesting subversive commentary. I'm very thankful that this didn't go the DC way of, you know, does it mean to be a superhero? Am I ready for being a superhero? This kind of stuff.
It's more of just a surface level, like sincere superhero narrative.
Sincere, and also James Wan, I got to give him credit. His underwater world building is actually interesting.
Yeah, how's the action? I've heard it's pretty big scale.
It's very big scale. And also, there's, you know, incredibly well lit, which is good. Not a dark DC film. It's not like everything is happening at night.
Bright, colorful, Avatar-esque?
Yeah, not as much. Still the sepia-toned kind of feel to it, unfortunately. Okay. But like it's got, you know, the spectacle element to it.
Mm.
It really is takes the time to show you parts of the world, and not everything is building up to an action set piece.
Right.
It still has this, you know, the usual beat of an action film that it has to go through, but it's still taking time to actually, you know. But here's a cutaway shot to something interesting, which is part of this world, which you're not going to see again. But you know, it adds to the whatever interesting thing for the world, and it's a quest story. You know.
Yeah.
The hero has to go through. It's essentially The Lion King, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. So is Black Panther.
Essentially, it is Black Panther. It is the same template.
Thank God we have someone like M. Night Shyamalan to bust this template
open,
right?
The reluctant son of, you know, a kingdom isn't sure whether he's ready to take over, has to find his half-brother, Orm, essentially, for the throne. It's Black Panther. It's basically DC's Black Panther.
Okay,
but fun.
So continuing.
Also, Amber Heard, actually. The female characters are the more interesting ones in this one, which have more to do.
Same is true of Black Panther.
And here, especially Amber Heard's character is playing, you know, Mira, saves the life of Aquaman, Arthur Curry, quite a few times, and she gets nothing in return. So she gets a pretty raw deal, to be honest. But, you know, all she has to do is then romance Jason Momoa, which I guess in some cases you can call that a pretty good deal from where you're looking at it. But like, as a character, he's not really that interesting. He's just like a very thick blockhead.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, cool. But like,
just like Thor.
Yeah. So it's Nicole Kidman who plays his mother, and Amber Heard who plays his love interest, get a lot more to do, and it's not very interesting. William Dafoe is interesting as well. So yeah, all dudes around him, pretty cool. Women around him, pretty cool. Him, not so much. But he's hot.
God, it sounds exactly the same as Black Panther in
but
so many
hot.
Ways.
Yeah.
So continuing the superhero trend,
yes. It's
still around in cinemas. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. What do we think?
Oh my God, I loved it.
Yeah.
It's the best Spider-Man movie since my very first Spider-Man experience.
Right. I think personally, I still prefer Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
But only just. For me, these films are pretty much evenly matched. And for me, that puts them right at the top of the superhero genre. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is a CG animated Spider-Man movie about Miles Morales taking up the mantle of Spider-Man after learning about the existence of multiple dimensions and the ability for there to be multiple different Spider-Men. It's an unusual take, but the meta-ness I felt was interesting because it's honest to the way that we engage with these characters these days. I mean, it's very much a film for our time. I think it's hard for people to just watch the standard
origin
superhero
story template. Yeah.
That's right. The standard, you know, the innocent young boy becomes super strong superhero thing when we're seeing it all the time in so many different variations. So I think there's something honest about meeting the audience's expectations to say, yes, this character exists in many different guises. Superheroes aren't that special. They're actually all out there just beyond the veil that the characters in the film can't see. The opening sequence brings in memes about Spider-Man that exist in a flatter to the audience and say, this is Spider-Man, and show him as a comic book character.
Which also kind of like made me realize that maybe the best medium for superhero and comic movies are still
cartoons.
Animation.
Absolutely.
And there's so much more inventiveness that you can actually put in.
Yeah.
The actual comic book feel to it, you know, the closest we've come to that in the real world is Scott Pilgrim, essentially.
Yeah.
But still, like, well, this had a lot of... And
The Japanese, you know, almost all their animation industry comes from animating the massive comic book surplus. And this film, I think, actually borrows a lot from the Japanese approach.
It does.
There's some...
Well, it has a Japanese...
character in it, yeah. Nice tip of the hat. A Japanese Spider-Man.
Without it being, you know, completely racist or xenophobic, which also I appreciate it, because usually when you go different culture, unfortunately, it doesn't have a good track record.
This was respectful. This is probably the most visually inventive Hollywood film of the year. 2018. There's some really striking compositions. I found it interesting that the animation style is this kind of, again, anime-esque staccato style,
yes,
where instead of it being in fluid 24 frames per second, they've done what Japanese animators often do, which is animate less frames but make more interesting and dynamic frames.
Yeah. And each frame is leading into different styles which you wouldn't expect. You would because you know how our brains work, that we preempt the next shot.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard this, like, I've seen this much, and then your brain starts forming the next scene.
That's the art of animation.
Exactly, and it's all about predicting, and they usually, what this film does really well is that it just plays with that expectation.
Yeah, because
a lot of those scenes where you think that, oh, this is now going to be the next shot, nope, it's like something else happens.
Comic book and anime-esque effects where suddenly the frame comes alive with color.
Yeah.
You know, like the background that has been replaced by speed lines.
I was thinking a lot about Night of Short Walk on Girl when I was watching this.
Right.
Because I was getting a lot of that, especially how, you know, you have these quick cutaways about, you know, expectations versus what actually happens. And it plays around with your visual narrative in the bicycle scenes in Night of Short Walk on Girl.
Right.
And, you know, you have this sort of very fast thing and, you know, he's sort of dodging a lot of things. And that's how the spider sling scenes are done as well. The point of view shots in Spider-Man, especially, which is most fun to do in any Spider-Man movie, because, you know, he's just literally flying across the city, are also really interesting because you get to see him stumble in ways
so
that
are,
very,
so
very
dynamic.
It's a first-person kind of feel to it.
This is one of the few Hollywood films in recent times, Glass would be another, that I feel is actually trying to do interesting, different things with the camera. You know, I feel like trying to surprise people in the way and trying to film things in different ways seems to be going away.
A lot of the times I did feel I was, watching a first-person kind of film where I Spider-Man, and it was seen from that perspective.
And the way that the multi-dimensional stuff was depicted was really
eye-popping
out
the
there, psychedelic
The noir Spider-Man.
The noir Spider-Man, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my
great
God.
Design.
It's great. But also, like, that was almost occupying a part of the frame where the colors were totally, like, you know, deliberately different from the rest of the frame.
So much visual creativity. Going back to the story of it, I found
that... It has a story as well, guys.
It does have a story. Just a visual experience.
Malik sort of intuitions got away from us. It does have a story. It's a proper, you know, narrative film. Don't worry about it. You know, they have the plot and everything else.
All those things. This film made me care about some of the aspects of the Spider-Man origin story that are, you know, completely played out, that, you know, the Andrew Garfield movies, for example, when they rehash these elements, I just thought, I do not give a shit. Whereas in Into the Spider-Verse, they've found ways to refresh, play with the scale of how we perceive Spider-Man with Miles Morales and the stakes up against him and his place in the world so that the usual beats of his origin story really hit hard and feel fresh. They've found ways to surprise you.
I mean, even the alternate universe of Peter Parker and what was going through.
That was great.
That was a very interesting sort of take of like, what would Peter Parker be in his midlife crisis?
Yeah, and it's interesting. This movie brings in a lot of aspects of the Spider-Man character that have been in the comics but haven't really been in the films before, because before the... Spider-Man as an adult struggling with his relationship with Mary Jane and trying to be a good guy is a thing that's been in the comics, but the films have always avoided it. But now that they have the freedom not just to keep Peter Parker as a relatable to the young audience teenage character by introducing this multi-dimensional thing, we're able to have that in Miles Morales and then see
even with Miles, what I found really interesting was the political commentary, especially with this family dynamic of, you know, what being part of, you know, African-American is in this kind of contemporary universe.
Much better than Black Panther, in my
opinion. Especially, you know, because his dad is a police officer, so there is this kind of pressure to uphold the law.
Yeah.
Even though you're part of the hood. So, like, all these kind of conflicting, interesting undertones of, you know, embracing black identity, black culture, while also trying to fit in with...
Because his uncle is a criminal, while his dad is a cop.
Yeah, you know? So it's interesting. And this is a story that actually, what I'm sort of keep hearing about all the time from African-American sort of narratives is about the struggle to actually get accepted as, you know, not the other, but somebody this part film, of the right side of the tracks.
And this film weaved it in a subtle way.
Very subtle.
Now that we've spent all this time praising it, I have to complain.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. are you sure? Are you sure we're up for breaking the love and mutual not? Appreciation of Into the Spider-Verse?
I mean, to be honest...
About to be disrupted?
Like, we're complaining about movies that are universally loved and loving movies that are universally complained about. So I guess we're still on brand.
Right.
So it's okay.
I felt like this film disappointed me in the last stretch, because until then it's been so, I think, different in the way it feels, and suddenly it gets overwhelmed in this
CGI heavy
action sequence with giant falling things in space. Like, just felt like, okay, we've moved from, you know, we're back into familiar territory now. We're back into this film doing the same thing as every other superhero film, when up until that moment it had felt like a new take.
But even then, what I did find quite uplifting was the whole idea of Miles' character actually taking that leap of faith and actually believing a much more genuine origin story. Because I know that's basically every superhero's reluctant struggle.
Yeah.
Am I worth it? Am I, you know, why do I have to carry the mantle?
Quite as Spider-Man, because the point of Spider-Man is that he's not Superman. He's a teenager.
Yeah, exactly.
And he has self-doubt.
Yeah.
And he has to rise to the challenge.
But I think with this movie, especially with the stakes, which actually...
The stakes were really great.
Really did. And you could see
the stakes in relation to the scale of Miles Morales and his struggle, and also like the sense of danger. It was so much more prevalent than it is in any of the big Marvel releases, save for Infinity War.
Yeah, but also like, because the stakes were very
consequences
personal.
Feel real, and it's very personal.
Personal, so
say.
It wasn't about saving the world. It's mostly about saving your family, which is like, you know, in a very personal thing for a teenager.
Right,
I think that would matter more anyway than, you know, the world.
That's true.
As an abstract concept,
I agree.
You know, what is the world? My world is my family.
Yeah, and I think this pulled this off in a way that made it feel way more significant than Spider-Man: Homecoming.
Yeah.
Which tried to make it a more personal struggle, but to me still felt kind of empty and overinflated, as Marvel tends to.
Because this is also sincere. Both Glass and this one are more sincere than Aquaman or any other kind of movie, which is trying to basically be a cash grab, which is, they're succeeding in doing that, but anyway.
Agreed. But yeah, something that disappointed me about this film, when the massive spectacle overwhelmed it, I felt like I was actually wanting to see more development towards the resolution of the dynamic between Peter Parker and Miles Morales, which really is the heart of this film. And it made me feel that, you know, the obligations to the genre will trump that. So that when that resolution came, it felt like it was a little bit too soon and not worthy of the development leading up to it. Like the film just dropped the ball at the last minute.
I didn't mind it, mainly because like I wasn't expecting it to be that good anyway.
Right, but the movie was already way above
expectations. Yeah, exactly. So
it's
like,
just that when it's so built finally, up this sort level of like, quality, you want it to
it sort of staccatoed to like plateaued into some kind of an end rather than, like, you know, rising, because it was already so high.
Yeah.
I think it was just like, oh, okay, you know.
But yeah, to...
But also, like, the smaller nods about, you know, having Dr. Octopus as a character and...
Oh, yeah, the way they do Dr. Octopus was fantastic and very surprising.
The reveal was actually pretty funny, yeah.
Yeah, it was hilarious. That scene was so creatively staged. So same as even a conversation scene between Miles and Gwen.
Yes.
Where... The frame reminded me of some of the more inventive anime direction I've seen, where, you know, the frame pauses and you're hearing thoughts inside his mind as he's analyzing the scene in slow motion. Again, you know, really original direction. There's so much stuff this film does well. And yet, I had this niggling sense of, I think, disappointment at the end of it. And I think maybe this says more about me.
Because it's a Marvel movie, Chris. Well, that's where the disappointment comes in.
Right. It probably says more about me than the film. But
you were like, the logo, it has to disappoint me sometime.
Yeah. When at the end of the movie, as I said, you know, it kind of short shrimps the Peter Parker and Miles Morales thing being resolved. And then it really heavily pushes the message of, like, Miles Morales is here, baby. We've got a new Spider-Man to close out. And yeah, they always needed to put the focus on Miles Morales is here. But I felt like I could see the corporate machinery behind the scenes of, like, the corporate executives leaning over the shoulder of the filmmakers. Like, don't forget, guys, this is about establishing a new Spider-Man. This is about establishing a new universe we can make Spider-Man movies and sequels to. And, like, maybe once that suspicion creeps into your head, you can't help but be a cynical bastard about everything else. Because I started to think, like, okay, it was cool to see all the multidimensional different Spider-Men, but maybe we spend so much time with them as opposed to developing some of the more emotional beats more because we have to sell toys of different versions of Spider-Man.
That's true. I mean, it's still a pretty...
It still is a cool thing and funny to see these different Spider-Men, but... I don't know. It's just hard. Like, it's like the well is poisoned with the superhero franchising.
I agree.
It on its own terms anymore.
Because, like, you know, it's still a production kind of, you know, studio backing. It's still trying to set up something else. Everything is setting up something else. They're nothing individual on its own.
Yep.
So, like, but I'm still glad that they could leave that for the last 2 minutes rather than, you know...
Making it the
yeah, make it, yeah. It's still less of a cash grab than a lot of other movies. I'm not...
Probably true.
Yeah, even like with Avengers, like it's not as blatantly histrionic. It's not as blatantly dull.
Yeah,
or boring, or even just it's trying. And at this stage, I would just be happy with trying.
I agree with that, but there's a rant incoming.
Yeah.
I think that says something about, like, where we are in terms of how we respond to superhero films now. Because I thought, like, yeah, this film's trying really hard while being one of those films, and it's better than getting a big budget Marvel blockbuster that doesn't try, you know, which is what we've become used to. But it felt strange to me that so much creativity is being put into a Spider-Man project. And again, it's like how you'd rather have beautifully directed ads than boring ads, because if they're going to be there, at least they'd be beautiful. But it also makes you think, like, why is that being spent on this?
Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's the most risk-averse project. Like, they have less to lose with Spider-Man as an entity and anything.
Which allows them to take risks.
Than with, like, Batman or, like, Superman, yeah.
But, no, but also, I think...
The mythology of Spider-Man is a lot more flexible because we haven't had them established.
But also because we already have the live-action Spider-Man, so they're hedging their bets by... You know, we have a safe live-action Spider-Man. We're allowed to experiment with this smaller-budget animated one.
But even then, like, the legacy of Spider-Man on the screen is a lot less than what legacy of Superman and Batman is.
But no, but Spider-Man, I think, is almost as popular a character as Batman.
He is in the comic books, but the problem is, like, we haven't had that on-screen legacy that Batman or Superman have had.
Right, which gives him flexibility.
But also with Tom Holland playing a younger Spider-Man, I think it just set it up to have that, you know, and in the comic book kind of animated universe, to be like, okay, people are accepting of a more younger Spider-Man, which is actually age-appropriate as for the comics. So why not actually do that?
But look, I just... Looking at it, I felt like this is the devil's wager we have to take in the point we are with superhero movies is, okay, yes, you can have a movie with creative staging and eye-popping colors and, you know, all of the things that are lacking in the rest of the Hollywood programming, but it has to be Spider-Man. Like, you're not going to get that in an original project. That's too big a risk. You can have your Spider-Man-flavored, interesting, inventive animated film,
I
and
agree.
That's it. Like, why isn't this experimentation in everywhere else? Why, you know...
I see what you're trying to say.
I kind of, it feels like you know, like the marketing side of filmmaking used to be like, let's find a market for this product. But now it's like dictating the whole thing. Let's design a product for the market. The market is lacking inventive, visually exploratory, sincere film. So let's make a Spider-Man one for that market. And it's like, it's even though I've really liked this film a lot, it still feels sad to me.
It is
that
sad. The whole state
have to get that in a Spider-Man film and nowhere else.
The whole state of mainstream cinema is sad to me.
Yeah, very, very sad.
But also, from a marketing perspective, and I can speak to that from as a marketing person, that's true of any product these days. Like, you know, it's not about finding your audience and trying to find a niche that you can sell a product to or fulfilling customer need. It's mostly about seeing what legacy you already have and just building upon that.
Yeah,
it's becoming, you know, for example, let's say the iPhone is a classic example of this. We'll just make minor updates and just make them, you know, buy something which promises, you know, just little improvements rather than actually changing the game.
Yeah.
What they did, changing the game, has already happened, you know, the first iPhone or the first iPod Shuffle or whatever. And now it's just about being risk averse and just building to the next update.
Yeah.
That's where we are as a consumption society, unfortunately. We also don't have imagination in that sense. I think we're just fatigued in how much we are offered choice. So I think it's difficult to grab someone's attention because you have to do it in 5 seconds. And so it's easier to sell them a product which already has
Spider-Man
legacy and nostalgia
Spider-Man
attached to it.
With the other stuff you've been missing in mainstream cinema.
Rather than a new superhero or a new thing which people, you know, have to find interest in or nostalgia with.
Yep.
Just play with nostalgia and feelings. It's manipulate people. Simple, easy, makes money.
And there's the trademark Film Fight Club cynicism.
Yeah, well.
And now to a couple of Boxing Day releases, The Favourite and Vice. Firstly, Vice.
Yeah, let's do Vice first. Why not?
Yep.
We're full of vices anyway.
Yeah, well, this film...
Yeah, it was full of vices.
Committed a lot of vices.
Yeah, which is sad, because I kind of like Adam McKay, to be honest.
I
like The Big Short quite a bit.
What a strange career trajectory. He went from being like the king of Hollywood dumb comedies, Anchorman, Step Brothers, etc., into clearly winning an Oscar.
Yeah. But still, like, you can see that there is some part of the soul of an actual creative filmmaker left.
That's true.
And it's just that it's lost in being quippy now.
Well, the thing about The Big Short, what set it apart is it's...
Margot Robbie in a bathtub trying to explain economics to me, which really did set it apart.
Well,
and I really
actually,
did learn a lot.
Yes, those sorts of things did set it apart because he went into this sort of prestige movie material with an interesting and an unusual take. And I think that is still there in Vice.
Yeah.
It's the other stuff. Formally, it's interesting. Vice is about Vice President Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
It's a biopic of him. It's something I don't think anyone asked for. So you'd think Adam McKay might have something interesting and different to say about him.
Well,
no.
I think it's made essentially to make you feel better at the fact that, the fact that Donald Trump is president. You know, the world is not entirely effed. We've had these similar moments of catastrophe and we've gotten through them. But I still don't see the point of this film.
What's interesting about this film, it's formal. It uses, some Malick-style cinematography. There it is.
First one, you know, second, third, Malick Rivera, whatever. Yeah. I lost count.
Yeah, Scorsese-style editing, Scorsese-style narration, but it doesn't feel like a Scorsese imitator. Adam McKay is his own person because he adds in surreal elements, cutaways, strange comedy moments that come out of nowhere.
True, that is
he
true.
Has the instinct to create something different to what everyone else is doing, and I appreciate that. But what does this film have that's new to say about Dick Cheney? It constantly treats him as... He's a cipher. Like, what actually is motivating him? Why is he doing the things he's doing? We spend almost 2 hours, 20 minutes exploring his journey, but we never really find out why he's doing what he's doing. But the mystery about
Because Cheney in this film is just an object of ridicule, right?
That's true.
In a way, a Saturday Night Live sketch.
I think
that's
true.
Which is part of the problem with how I think the world has come to deal with Trump as well.
Right.
That we've actually... think that, you know, he's just an object of ridicule and a buffoon as such, without actually trying to diagnose what makes him so incredibly attractive or powerful or whatever. Like, we just refuse to go into the depth.
It's easy to just dismiss them like this film seems to do. Like, I wonder if the film is meant to make you wonder what's at the core of Dick Cheney, because there's scenes like showing him as an ominous silhouette bathed in shadow that suggest that's what he's going for, but it doesn't feel like the mystery is something that's being... that the other characters are wondering about. It really just feels like the mystery of who Dick Cheney is the void at the core of this film. Because I think politically, it's not telling you anything you don't know.
It's not a political film.
It's politically, it's just telling you bad things are bad. Bad people are bad. Those things you know are bad.
It's just making
people, you know, like, oh, big revelation. Dark forces are pulling the strings behind the scenes in American politics.
Isn't that the problem of left classical liberalism at this point, where, you know, it's all about making fun of things you don't understand?
Yeah,
it's everything is, you know, played up for a joke and a gag. Rather than trying to get to a point.
That's right. This movie dismisses characters and events with simple gags. But yeah, we spend so much time delving into Cheney. And I think a lot of people have wondered about the events like the lead up to the Iraq War and what's going on behind the scenes. And I think it's inexcusable to make a production on this budget with this much talent behind it and not present anything new or different to add to the debate. On top of that, you know, I honestly felt like Adam McKay was sneering at the audience. Though at the beginning of the movie, like, this movie's really self-satisfied.
Also very smug.
It's so smug.
It's just content with being smug. It's not trying to be sincere.
At the beginning and ending of the movie, there's moments where he's making fun of the perceived, large swaths of the perceived general public. Like, you're too dumb to care about the true history that I'm about to reveal. I just thought, why do I want to be told this by the guy who made Anchorman, you smug, rich Hollywood bastard? Like, this movie has no generosity towards the audience or towards its characters. And it seems like midway through the film, it's about to add a lot of depth to Dick Cheney, which I think Christian Bale does a decent job of providing.
Christian Bale actually...
He's not given much to work with.
Yeah, true. And he actually does more about what's on paper than actually is required. And that makes Cheney's character appear more interesting than he actually is, how it's written. Because McKay is just written as a one-note character. Christian Bale actually brings a lot more nuance to it. But the way it's written and how McKay envisions him, it's still played up as a buffoon from start to finish. Even in that characterization, there's no progress. Yep. Like, you know, he was a buffoon in the beginning. But like...
And I feel like...
Which is part of the problem, which had the same issue in Black Klansman.
Yeah.
You know, these are dangerous people. And laughing at Nazis or laughing at powerful people who are corrupt or completely out of their minds is not an adequate response anymore. It's been done, and it's
exactly
just
it's time
boring.
To really think more about why and how. And this
we're
film doesn't have anything to offer.
We're not content being laughing at fascists. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. It's just a big shrug of the movie. It just seems like a waste and a missed opportunity.
Like, comparing that with The Big Short, which actually tried to actually diagnose what caused the financial crisis and was very much interested in the repercussions and the aftermath and how it affected real people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has no emotional center.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't have an emotional core.
It's disconnected from real people as well as being disconnected from the mind, as if Adam McKay is such a smug liberal that he can't extend himself to actually try and imagine what's going through the heads of these people.
Yeah.
So that was Vice.
But you know, if you still like Adam McKay and you want that kind of Saturday Night Live feeling, you're still gonna go and watch it. So
Saturday Night Live meets like smug seriousness. It's this straight. He bit off more than he could chew, I think, as a filmmaker, because he didn't show here that he could balance the satire and the surreal gags seriousness of these events.
There's nothing new.
This
movie could not exist, and you still would know as much about Dick Cheney anyway.
That's exactly right. I don't feel like I really learned anything.
Yeah.
So on to The Favorite. The Favorite, if you don't know about it, it's about Queen Anne having,
it's a new Yorgos Lanthimos movie
about Queen Anne having her affections toyed with by different advisors, two women played by Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, who are fighting with each other over the Queen's affections.
Yeah, well, apparently it does have real basis in history about Queen Anne actually having two advisors, and they had a torrid, which was revealed after the advisor that fell out of favor wrote, you know, in her memoirs unfavorably about Queen Anne. So this is an interesting story. But essentially, it's a black comedy about proletariat and people of the rich ruling class and how that sort of it's actually the most accessible Lanthimos film.
Yeah,
we're talking about that way. It's still more formally basic. If you've approached Lanthimos movies before, it's not as fun as The Lobster. But it still is trying to go for that kind of comic bait in terms of its interesting, unexpected turns of phrases. Nicholas Holt.
Did you like it?
I
didn't like it that much either. I'm assuming I put words into your mouth there. But
yeah, but the thing is, like, it's a Boxing Day release, right?
Mm.
From the time it came out, I did like it.
Mm.
As a Boxing Day movie, I think it's still the most interesting of all the Boxing Day releases.
I think that's true, yeah.
So in the time it came out as a holiday release, I think it still got a lot more traction. And so, yes.
Right.
If it came out in any other more interesting time.
Right. We're starved a bit at the moment.
Yeah. But still, like, you know, as Lanthimos and what he's doing, I still don't think it's a bad movie. It's just a less interesting movie than his other movies.
Olivia Colman.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. I think she really lifts the whole thing because as Queen Anne, she brings a lot of interior life and sadness and emotional depth to this. I just want to say, outside of the performances, I don't think there was enough depth. I think the script is really, really self-satisfied to the point of being, I just used that descriptor for two films in a row.
Yeah.
But both released on the same day. Yeah, that this film is self-satisfied to the degree, to the extent of being smug. Like in the script, which is full of profanity, often to me doesn't feel, with some exceptions, it mostly doesn't feel that witty in the way it's used. More that I could feel a sense of like schoolboy, schoolgirl, like teehee, you know, aren't we being so bold and shocking by making a period piece where people use the C word? Like,
the thing is, though, at some point, and a lot of that credit has to go to Olivia Colman. She's the only character that's got any transformation or progress. Like in the beginning, she's seen as that kind of character for comic relief that's going to be played around. But then you find out, like, you know, there's actual layers to her character and what she's gone through and how she deals with grief and emotion. And that turn is amazing because you forget at what point you started caring about her. You don't do that with any other character in this movie.
Yeah, the problem for me is that most...
She's the only emotional center of the film.
Most of the film is not about her and her struggles. It's really more about the catfight between Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz's characters.
And that's fun, but
there's
less
not
interesting.
Much, yeah, there's not much emotional depth to it at all. It's once you realize what's going on between them, the film just goes to a holding pattern and repeats the same kind of antics of one-upping each other that they've been doing so far.
It was still fun... Okay, Rachel Weisz has done this before in The Lobster and whatever. She can play this kind of acerbic character in her sleep. But it was more interesting for me to see Emma Stone actually embrace that kind of quick-talking, quippy side to her character because I didn't think she had it in her to do that. She actually...
I just didn't
play against type.
She does. I just didn't care that much for these characters or their conflict, as I said, because it just repeats itself, which is the same problem I had with Killing of a Sacred Deer last year.
Killing was terrible.
It establishes a psychological dynamic and gamesmanship between characters and then repeats that, as if dragging something out provides it with more depth, but it doesn't.
At least this didn't have that kind of hypertext way of talking that Lanthimos associates with people who are rich.
Yes, perhaps
and
having
the ruling class.
A new different screenwriters helped out in that department.
But there were some jokes.
Amusing at first.
But there were some jokes that were really funny. For example, I remember specifically a sexual assault joke which Emma Stone talks about, which really took me off guard and was actually
funny.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Very dark.
Very dark. Okay. You know, but anyway.
But it's just, I think it's what I'm complaining about is a failure of the directing as much as it is of the writing, because it's not just the lack of depth in the screenplay, it's the way that Lanthimos overlabors it and treats everything as if it has more significance than it does.
It need to be divided into chapters, for example.
If the psychology of the warfare, the psychological warfare between these two characters was only going to be this deep, it didn't need to be labored over for so long. The ending of the film, I think, is pretty much a shrug after all this build-up, but Lanthimos does the same thing he did in Killing of the Sacred Deer, provide this massively anticlimactic ending with like the sense of grand tragedy and really push the point as if we didn't get it. It's like
but,
enough,
but, dude. But the thing is, with that is actually the turn, especially for Olivia Colman's character in the last third and her deterioration,
that
wasn't established as
that
much.
That should have been more of the focus.
Because, like, you know, we suddenly see her, you know, at that stage, and then in the next shot we see her almost, she's almost a different person because she looks visibly completely spent.
Yeah.
And I was like, when did this, like, there's this passage of time.
Spend some time on that because that's more interesting than
And
than
actually,
the main
her journey was always, you know, it's Queen Anne's journey, it's Queen Anne's dilemma in the end, and we get little time with that.
Yeah.
The two characters around, they're fun, but actually they're the least interesting because they get to play one note to people.
Exactly. Aesthetically, I also had some issues with this. I think Lanthimos establishes a style which is very much drawn from Barry Lyndon, but he once he establishes a bunch of visual strategies, he uses the same ones for every single scene. So the film, for me, at first it's like, oh, this is striking with the use of the huge wide-angle lenses.
Yeah.
And, you know, fish eyes and off-center framing, the camera pushing in and tilting upwards. But then you notice that as opposed to this... a new visual strategy being created for every scene to try and get at the core of what's that about, which is what a director like Kubrick actually does. He has a distinctive style, but he's always looking for the right way to shoot the scene. In this, I felt like Lanthimos had thought up a few visual strategies and used it as a blanket approach for every single scene, and that makes the style feel less like it the right way, you know, a well thought through way to visualize the drama or the, you know, the nature of the scene, than it does just a visual affectation that he's slapdash applied over everything.
But like I think Lanthimos does that.
He's just
with
putting on a mask.
Every movie that he actually has made so far, like, it's mostly about affectation.
Right.
Right.
Even in the dialogue as well.
Yeah,
it's
also but it's the same thing. You know, the idea of using grand operatic music or jazz music, or, you know, in The Killing, for example, using music cues from Greek tragedy to heighten every scene, it does get repetitive, and you kind of see that affectation rather than actually doing something creative. It's fun for the first two or three scenes, and then it becomes like, oh, okay, I get the point.
Yeah.
But anyway, for most mainstream audiences, it's still more inventive than anything they would see on a Boxing Day release.
Well, yeah, that's
I think
true.
That we need to acknowledge that. You know, it's still interesting when we went to see it, for example, that we had enough people there who were interested in this kind of a film.
Yeah.
Which usually, okay, maybe we need mainstream actors like Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz to actually, you know, do these kind of projects to get mainstream commercial appeal, to get these people into, you know, palace
cinema. Lanthimos, you know, something a bit unusual.
I know he's not that unusual, but for a lot of people, he's unusual. So I got to
be pretty unusual in some
films. I got to give that credit as much.
Right.
And actually, part of me is happy that we're getting, you know, mainstream actors trying to experiment with their whatever,
with their character, with their persona,
personas and whatever, you know, trying.
This is against type for Emma Stone, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And you know,
there are pleasures to be had in this. It just feels like a very,
for example,
one note simple film, which is really being propped up.
What my favorite sort of character was Nicholas Holt, to be honest.
And I agree. Yeah, Nicholas Holt was fantastic.
And he was having a lot of fun.
Clearly,
and actually, for once again, a very one note character, he was the one who had the most fun, most throwaway gags in the way his dialogue delivery worked. Once again, actually stole the thunder in a few scenes, which I was not expecting, because he actually delivers the lines in a way that you don't expect.
That's true.
Like, you know, there's some actual physical comedy that he brings in, which for a film that relies so much on speechifying, once again, and a lot of witty wordplay, when the physical comedy aspect comes in, it really, really,
and
really...
And Nicholas Holt supplies a lot of that.
Exactly. So, because I didn't see him in that kind of vein, so it was interesting. So yeah, Nicholas Holt, surprise package, incredibly talented. Great wigs.
Right, right.
Great wigs.
I spent a lot of time last year when we were talking about Killing of a Sacred Deer. Or was it the year before? God, time flies.
Yeah.
Complaining about...
Deers were killed sometime.
Yeah. The shining fetishism all over that film. And here, as I made reference to earlier, it's replaced by Barry Lyndon. You know, aesthetically, in terms of these ornate to the end, ornate over-the-top locations and makeup on the characters, and the focus on the frivolousness of courtly life, and the shooting everything by candlelight, but also in terms of the contours of the plot, where this is about a person coming from a low social class and scheming their way to the top. But I think thinking about this comparison reveals the flaws of the film and a lot of Lanthimos's approach in general. I would say, if you know, Kubrick is always thought of as like an ice cold filmmaker. But if you look at Barry Lyndon, he at least allows us room to empathize with this character, even as he's satirizing his type and judging Barry Lyndon himself. If you compare his character to Emma Stone in this film, The Social Schema, there is no empathy. There's so much less. It's such a one-note, shallow artwork in comparison to what Kubrick put out. And I think if you're going to imitate the best, when you draw comparisons to something that great, you've got to have more to live up to them.
I agree. It doesn't do so in directorial choices, but I still think the ability in terms of casting makes this film a lot more interesting than it is. Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, and Olivia Colman, all three of them, Nicholas Holt, even Mark Gatiss. All these people actually played their parts much better than it was written. They brought a lot more dimension to their roles.
It's very much an actor's film.
It's an acted
British
film.
British actor's film.
Yeah, you know.
The grand tradition.
Yeah, you know, had some high tea and scones and coffee and whatever. No, you don't have coffee with high tea, you just have tea. Okay, whatever.
High tea and coffee is like for the true caffeine addicts.
All right, okay, you know, clearly I haven't had high tea, so you can tell my Indian heritage is coming through there.
Well, you can. There's going to be more time to enjoy high tea over the rest of the summer before we return.
Yes. Also, I'll be watching some tennis, and Chris will be having not high tea at Rainbow Serpent and other substances.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe tea.
Look, I'm sticking to tea, okay? That's true. Virat clearly doesn't know me well enough.
Tea is very soothing.
Tea is indeed very soothing.
We'll
be back when we return. Because of the slapdash way that we've put this together, I can't remember when Glenn is coming back. I'm pretty sure we're returning mid-February.
Like James Bond, Glenn Falkenstein will return.
Yes, he will.
In the next episode.
Fight Club will return. But until then, we're going to keep doing things
our way.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Love movies. See you later.
Hate Limp Bizkit, but play it anyway for the lols.
Okay, this is...
Hate yourself for saying for the lols on live radio.
That's okay. Self-loathing is our brand. This is Virat Nehru and Chris Evans. Good night. Love movies. Fight over them.
Bye-bye.